mass shootings in one day. A gunman killed 22 people in El Paso in a white supremacist attack. And shock and sadness turned to anger after 9 people were killed in a shooting in Dayton. Today on The Takeaway, how the communities are reacting and the history of anti-Latino violence in the United States. I'm Tanzina Vega. Also on the show, black home ownership has dropped to its lowest point since 1970.
Across the entire nation, the home ownership rate between black and white Americans and the gap persists in just about every jurisdiction across the country. So there is no place that has closed the gap.
It's a heavy podcast today, so let's get to it. Vigils in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, where community members gathered to mourn their dead. Over the weekend, at least 29 people were killed and dozens more were injured in 2 mass shootings. At a Walmart in El Paso on Saturday afternoon, a gunman killed 20 people and wounded more than 24 others. It was one of the deadliest attacks against Latinos in U.S. history. Nearly 20 minutes before opening fire, authorities say the suspect, a 21-year-old white man, posted a hate-filled manifesto that included language echoing the rhetoric of President Trump and his supporters. In it, he said the attack was a, quote, response to the Hispanic invasion of Texas. Within 13 hours of the El Paso shooting, a gunman in Dayton killed 9 people, including his sister, in the span of 1 minute in the city's popular entertainment district. 2 mass shootings in the span of 24 hours. They follow 2 other mass shootings from the weekend before, one in New York City and one in Northern California. And on Monday, President Trump addressed the country.
In one voice, our nation must condemn racism, bigotry, and white supremacy. These sinister ideologies must be defeated.
We're going to talk more about the rise of white supremacist violence and the history of anti-Latino hate in the region in our next story. But first, to give us an update on the shootings in El Paso and Dayton, we're joined by Bob Moore, founder of El Paso Matters and former editor of the El Paso Times. Welcome to The Takeaway, Bob.
Good to be with you again.
And Jess Mador is the managing editor of Dayton's public radio station, WYSO. Jess, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Bob, let's start with you. What's been the response from your community so far, and how has it changed over the past few days?
It really shifted from shock on Saturday to anger on Sunday and into today, after it became clear that somebody drove 10 hours to come to our community to murder people simply for being Latino.
Jess, what's the response been so far in Dayton? How has it changed as the shock of the immediate terror has worn off?
Yeah, I mean, there is still a lot of shock here, but last night, you know, we had a familiar routine at this point in so many cities. There was a candlelight vigil at the site of the shooting, and more people than I've ever seen in Dayton. Hundreds and hundreds of people, you know, came. They sang and released doves and read the names of the victims. But just like your other guest said, you know, the mood sort of shifted. And then when the Ohio Governor Mike DeWine took the stage, there were some chants that erupted, demanding change about gun violence in our country.
Jess, do they have anything specific that they want DeWine to do other than change? Were there specific demands?
Well, in terms of the crowd, they just kept chanting, you know, make a change, do something. And, you know, there's a host of bills at the legislature, but, it's unclear whether anything's got a chance of coming close to passing. But some of those could include a red flag law that could allow courts to take guns out of the hands of people seen as a threat. But, you know, again, everything is sort of, there's nothing close to passing.
Bob, we know, and as you mentioned, the gunman apparently traveled more than 600 miles from Dallas to El Paso to carry out this attack. Are people connecting any of the rhetoric we've heard from the president to this attack so far?
Absolutely. The president has used the language of invasion to describe the influx of families at our southern border. That word appears in the manifesto to try to disconnect the president's rhetoric from that act is just foolish. It's absolutely connected. Words have consequences, which is something that people here have been warning for a couple of years now. I wish I could say I was surprised that this happened, but I'm not.
I want to ask you both, we've got just 2 minutes left in the segment, but the president is expected to make remarks later this morning. And so far, he's called for increased background checks and has also, in limited remarks, said that this has to do with mental illness. Bob, how has your community responded to that? And Jess, I'd like to hear about the Dayton community as well.
Governor Abbott came here the day of the shooting and couldn't even utter the word hate crimes. He instead, again, talked about mental illness. First of all, people with serious mental illness are far more likely to be victims of violent crimes than perpetrators. There's certainly a need for increased mental health care in this country. But if we use that as an excuse to do nothing else on gun violence and white supremacy, then nothing will change.
Jess, your thoughts on the president and what the community reaction has been so far?
Yeah, I mean, yesterday we had state and federal lawmakers, some of Ohio's senators and lawmakers from Congress, you know, talking about the same stuff, you know, talking about the need for a what they called a bipartisan conversation about guns and mental health. And that's pretty much where the comments ended. There were few details on what a conversation like that could look like or who might start that off.
Jess Mador is the managing editor of Dayton's public radio station, WYSO, and Bob Moore is the founder of El Paso Matters and the former editor of El Paso Times. Thank you both for being here, and we wish you and your communities peace.
Thank you.
So much.
The mass shooting in El Paso was one of the deadliest attacks on Latinos in U.S. history. The violence rocked the border town, which is more than 80% Latino. And before this weekend, the city prided itself as being one of the safest in the country. The rhetoric in the Post online just before the shooting included references to a, quote, Hispanic invasion. But there is a dark history of anti-Latino violence in the American West. Historians estimate that between 1910 and 1920, around 5,000 people of Mexican descent were killed or vanished. We're now joined by two guests who are going to help us contextualize what happened in El Paso over the weekend. And we'll start with Monica Munoz Martinez, a professor at Brown University and author of the book, The Injustice Never Leaves You, Anti-Mexican Violence in Texas. Monica, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
So we just mentioned this dark history of anti-Mexican, anti-Latino violence. Tell us exactly what it has consisted of.
Well, most people don't know the long history of anti-Mexican violence in the United States, which unfortunately ranges from hundreds of people who've been victims of lynchings at the hands of mobs across the United States, but also in a place like Texas between 1910 and 1920, as you stated, ethnic Mexicans who were both American citizens and also Mexican nationals were victims of vigilante violence, but also state-sanctioned violence at the hands of Texas Rangers, which were the state police officers, local law enforcement, and also U.S. soldiers. And so this was a period of violence that when we think about racial violence on the border, it's important to remember that it's not only acts of state-sanctioned racial violence, but that those were linked with acts of vigilantes.
Joining us now is also Heidi Byrick, who's the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project. Heidi, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We're still waiting for confirmation by the police, but there has been talk of this shooter's manifesto, which is filled of anti-immigrant statements, particularly against Latinos. And there has been similar language that President Trump has used on the campaign trail and during his presidency. Can you make the connection for us there?
Sure. The kinds of language that Trump has used to describe immigrants, that they're invaders, they're rapists, they're not very good people. These kinds of sentiments are the same kinds of things that we see in this manifesto. And the bigger argument really is that there's sort of a terrible thing happening in the United States where immigrants are coming in and replacing the historically white population. That's really the basic point that this person was trying to make. It's why he engaged in this act of violence. And that is the same kind of thing when we hear Donald Trump or people like Tucker Carlson on Fox News and others talk about how, you know, there's this replacement going on with immigrants of real Americans. It's a very dangerous concept, and it's spreading like wildfire throughout white supremacist circles. And this idea has also inspired violence in Christchurch, New Zealand, in Poway, California, and other places. In fact, it's the main ideological position that we find in white supremacist circles right now.
Monica, I want to go back to the history here. We've talked on the show about the Red Summer, in which Black Americans were terrorized by white mobs. But there's also a horrific history of lynchings and killings of people of Mexican descent. Tell us about the 1918 Porvenir Massacre.
Yeah, so the Porvenir Massacre is one of the greatest tragedies that's unknown in U.S. history. It's a tragedy that took place in Presidio County, in a small community called Porvenir in West Texas. And in January 28th, 1918, a group of Texas Rangers, local residents, accompanied by U.S. soldiers, traveled to Porvenir in the middle of the night, removed 15 men and boys from their families, and in police custody, these men and boys were massacred. It's an event that is atrocious, but also one that carries sentiments of injustice 100 years later, because despite decades of efforts by families and witnesses to seek justice, nobody was ever prosecuted. And in fact, many of the Texas, there were participants who actually enjoyed long careers in law enforcement after this massacre. So it's an example of the kinds of atrocities that took place because Mexicans, regardless of whether they were American citizens or Mexican nationals, residents on the borderlands were being represented by politicians, but also by the media, as inherently violent people, as people who needed to be violently policed. And so they were denied due process. And so it's a history that we have to learn from because it shows the deadly consequences of racist rhetoric that leads to violent border policing, but also enables vigilante violence that we have politicians and policies that dehumanize Latinos and people who are coming to the United States looking for safety. But it also ignores the long history of Mexicans who've lived in the United States, who built places like El Paso, and many of the communities that were targeted with violence, like in Porvenir. These were communities where people were making life in the border region. In places like El Paso, people lived they were united by the life source of Rio Grande, and so people lived and worked on both sides of the border. These communities thrived in conjunction, but they were being completely misrepresented by politicians, by the press, and that enabled calls for the militarization of the border. But it also it completely erased and ignored the long histories of people, of Mexican Americans who were actively engaged in politics, who were landowning residents of the region, and who had an alternative vision of living on the border.
Why has this history, I never knew about this history, I didn't learn about this when I was growing up. Why has this history largely been lost to us?
Well, it's a history that's largely been erased from public memory because we actually celebrate some of the aggressors. So in Texas, the Texas Rangers are their heroes. They're the icons of masculinity and bravery and patriotism. But when we look at the long history of policing in Texas and across the country, agents like the Texas Rangers were agents of racial violence. And so when we have episodes like the Porvenir Massacre, for example, you know, that where you don't see prosecutions, what you actually see is a corrupt state record of Texas agents and investigating officers who tried to justify the crimes by criminalizing the deceased. And so there's a racial narrative that celebrates these kinds of the militarization of the border, that celebrates the violent policing of people on the border, that ignores the long history of people thriving in these regions, making life there, and claiming place in the borderlands.
And I want to talk a little bit about how that that connects to today in just a moment. But Heidi, Monica mentioned this term vigilante violence, at least in the history here. Heidi, how do we, is that what we're seeing today playing out with these attacks?
Well, it's, yes, there is vigilante activity going on right now at the current day. In the border regions, we just had in the last couple months a situation where a militia group was rounding up undocumented folks in southern Arizona. We've had that activity in Texas as well in the border regions. So this vigilante attitude towards immigrants continues to thrive. I would say what happened in El Paso is a bit more of it's a domestic terrorism situation. It's a reflection of how white supremacy is thriving in the minds of a lot of young white men, and they are beginning to feel that changing demographics is an existential threat and that the only way to stop it is through violence. Many of these men also feel that the policies coming out of the Trump administration haven't been strong enough. In other words, the wall hasn't been put up and Trump hasn't done enough to actually stop the dynamics that he's describing that are destroying the country. So we have both of these things going on at the same time, and frankly, the Latinx population is experiencing high levels of hate crime and harassment, all of this engendered by this political environment we're living in. But as Monica describes, we've had these kinds of things happening in our history and in Texas for many, many years, and we don't seem to learn very well from the horrors of these past incidents.
I also want to point out that we're seeing a lot of this also, not just in extreme militia groups and mass shootings, but many of us have seen videos of Latinos just living their daily lives and being told to go back to where they came from or to stop speaking Spanish. Where do you put that on the spectrum of this ideology, Monica?
Well, you know, certainly racism and discrimination manifests in different ways. But certainly, you know, if you look at the manifestation in policy, when you see the regular dehumanization of immigrants and refugees, people who are being detained, families that are being separated, children who are suffering irreparable harm, that kind of dehumanization, the criminalization in political rhetoric, we see that trickles out and shapes how people relate to each other and interact with each other on a daily basis. And my concern is not only how people are confronted by this on a daily basis, you know, on sidewalks or in restaurants, but also how this infiltrates the minds of policing. And so my real concern is thinking about not only these tragedies, these horrors that we've seen taking place in places like El Paso, but we have to think about the kinds of white supremacist logic that is motivating our immigration policies and our policing policies across the country.
Heidi, I want to talk a little bit about this sort of resurgence, if it's a resurgence or maybe an unmasking of white supremacist extremism. The Southern Poverty Law Center has been keeping an eye on this. Are we seeing an increase in this, or is it just more visible to us?
Well, I think both things are happening. First of all, we know the number of hate groups has surged by about 30% in the last 4 years. In fact, in 2018, we counted 1,020 hate groups. That's the highest that the Law Center has ever counted. We also know that hate crimes are up by about 30% as well during that time period. So racial violence of all kinds, the number of active hate groups are up. And we also have just an incredible spread of racist, anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim, anti-Semitic propaganda all throughout the web. The web has unleashed propaganda tools that these groups and individuals who believe these things never had before, and that is also spreading. We see with this manifesto in El Paso that it references directly prior acts like Christchurch. So there's a sharing of white supremacist thinking. And this is all, of course, coupled with the rise of right-wing populism across the Western world and the kinds of dehumanizing policies that Monica just talked about, the rhetoric from the White House. So we've got a problem that is substantially greater when it comes to white supremacy today than we had even 5 years ago. And yes, we're seeing more of it because it's frankly more visible.
Monica, this seems, at least, and I've said this many times before, whether or not this is a turning point. We've got about a minute left in the segment, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts on what impact this will have on white supremacist violence or the way people think about it, and more broadly, the Latino community.
Well, unfortunately, I have no doubt that without accountability from the public, patterns of violence are going to continue, and it's going to shape in generations to come. I hope that the public will stop turning a blind eye to violence that's taking place, to anti-immigrant sentiment when it's used, but also to protesting the kinds of policies that are inflicting harm today. We need elected officials to demand changes, and we have to, as a nation, respect human rights and respect the humanity of people. And if that's not a pillar of our democracy, then we have dark days ahead.
Monica Munoz-Martinez is a professor at Brown University and author of the book The Injustice Never Leaves You, Anti-Mexican Violence in Texas. And Heidi Byrick is the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
One in 10 households spend more than 50% of their income on just having a place to live. That's according to this year's County Health Rankings and Roadmaps report published by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. But like every other metric in the United States, these numbers hide the fact that Black and brown communities are dealing with this crisis at a greater rate than everyone else. One area where this is most pronounced is in the realm of home ownership. New data from the Census Bureau shows that Black home ownership is on the decline, and the percentage of Black families that own a home is at its lowest level in 50 years. Meanwhile, the Trump administration announced Friday that it intends to gut the 1968 Fair Housing Act, a federal civil rights legislation that gives enforcement to claims of discrimination in housing. Elena McCargo is the vice president of housing finance policy at the Urban Institute, and she joins me now to help us make sense of what's happening. Elena, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me, Tanzina.
So we just said the state of Black home ownership is at its lowest level in 50 years. Can you help us understand that in terms of where in the country? Is the decline more pronounced in certain regions?
Great question. So the national home ownership rate, and that's looking across all, you know, all states, is currently at the lowest level that we've seen in 50 years since the Fair Housing Act was passed. When you look at this situation around Black home ownership, state by state or region by region, it is very different locally. So it's a greater issue or of greater concern in some locations around the country. But I can tell you that across the entire nation, the home ownership rate between Black and white Americans and the gap persists in just about every jurisdiction across the country. So there is no place that has closed the gap.
Let's talk a little bit about the why now. We know that, there was a big housing crisis over a decade ago, and that affected different communities differently. But tell us about why Black home ownership is at this rate today.
Sure. So during the housing crisis, starting in about 2008, the Black and Hispanic population really suffered greatly from loss of home ownership or lots of loss of home equity. Since then, there has been, as you know, an economic recovery, and many, including the Hispanic population, have seen great recovery as it relates to building back up home ownership and wealth through home ownership. That has not been the case for the Black population. And that has a lot to do with two things. One is the real difficulty that there has been in getting access to mortgages and access to credit. And then secondly, the sustainability issue and just the fact that so many Black previously homeowner populations have now become renters.
I know in my own reporting, we found that in Milwaukee, for example, denial of mortgages is much higher for Black members of the community than it is for whites. Why is credit so hard to come by? Why are mortgages so hard to come by, particularly for Black Americans?
When the housing crisis happened, there was a big contraction in the mortgage market, and it affected all Americans. This was just essentially where mortgage lenders were taking on far less risk. They really began to pull back in terms of their lending. They really tightened up opportunities for homeowners with, you know, lower credit scores, possibly a little bit more debt on their credit profiles. That tightening has really continued. It hasn't loosened up as much as it could when you compare to historical standards of lending during good times when lending was happening that was very safe. Today, lenders continue to not take that risk, continue to still have some constraints in their lending that are having an outsized effect on the Black community because of the characteristics that many Black households have in terms of their credit profiles, lower incomes, and carrying higher debt, including student debt.
That lower income data that you're talking about also plays out often in how much wealth Black communities and to a larger extent, brown communities have. Here in New York City, for example, often people are asked to come up with a down payment of up to 20% of the value of the property, which is almost the barrier to entry is almost impossible for a lot of people. Is that something that also plays out for Black families?
Absolutely. Access to down payment assistance is out there. It's available. And there is still a misconception that folks have around the country that you need 20% down to get a mortgage and buy a home. That is not the case. And in some recent work that we did, a study called Barriers to Home Ownership in 2018, the Urban Institute with Freddie Mac and a group called Down Payment Resource. And that report shows that there are over 2,600 down payment assistance programs across the nation. The Federal Housing Administration, that's a low down payment program. The Veterans Administration, that's a zero down payment program. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are conventional lenders, both have low down payment programs. On average, we saw in 2017, most people, no matter what size or price home you're buying, are putting about 5% down at the median. So that misperception of that you have to save 20% down, which seems like an impossibility for most people these days, is something that we've got to make sure people understand you do not need 20% down to buy a home.
We mentioned that the Trump administration announced that it intends to essentially gut the 1968 Fair Housing Act, which gives essentially enforcement to people who are trying to make claims of housing discrimination. If that happens, what kind of impact, Elena, would that have on Black home ownership?
The Black home ownership gap has been here for as far as we've recorded housing data. So there has not been a time when there hasn't been this kind of enormous gap in home ownership and wealth in America. You have to look at history. You have to think about how neighborhoods were segregated, how cities were segregated, and how the opportunities for home ownership and better housing were just not available to Black families for so many years. I mean, we talk about access to credit and housing affordability and all these other things, but another key piece is discrimination in housing. It is something that has been here since the Fair Housing Act was passed, and there have been numerous cases brought against institutions and individuals in real estate and lending on the claims of fair housing discrimination. And the ability to enforce those laws and the ability to ensure that discriminatory practices, whether you're renting or buying a home, are something that can be enforced and kind of be taken out of our system is critical. So any work to minimize or diminish fair housing laws and disparate impact, which is the way in which these cases can be brought, are truly going in the wrong direction, especially given the persistent homeownership gap and housing discrimination that we continue to see in this country.
Elena McCargo is the Vice President of Housing Finance Policy at the Urban Institute. Elena, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we return to our top segment of the show, the mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio. And we'll be continuing to cover different parts of the stories, including the ties to online extremism. But we wanted to end our show today honoring the victims in El Paso and Dayton who have been identified. In El Paso, Jordan Anchondo, Andre Anchondo, Arturo Benavides, Mario de Alba, Jessica Coca Garcia, Memo Garcia, Sara Esther Regalado, Adolfo Cerros Hernandez, Jorge Calvillo Garcia, Elsa Mendoza de la Mora, Gloria Irma Marquez, Maria Eugenia Legarreta Roth, Ivan Filiberto Manzano, Angelina Inglesby, Leo Campos, Maribel Hernandez, Maribel Sáenz Pardo, Javier Rodriguez. In Dayton, Lois Oglesby, Megan Betts, Saeed Saleh, Derek Fudge, Logan Turner, Nicholas Coomer, Thomas McNichols, Beatrice Warren Curtis, Monica Brickhouse. And listeners, we know these are tough stories, and we're definitely feeling it here, and we know you're feeling it at home or at work or anywhere you're listening. Please know that you can reach out to us. We want to know what you're thinking about on El Paso, Dayton, or anything that's happening. We can be an ear. You can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for talking with us. As always, I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.